This is the summary version of Conversations About Change, which has been bringing thoughtful perspectives on technology, society, and change to the net every week since October 2004. For the full podcasts, please subscribe to the full version. Here's me, Jerry Mikulski, with a summary of this week's show.
So let me go back and recap quickly what we've talked about. Alvaro sent us a PowerPoint and then talked through it and talked about sort of what brought us up to date from our previous call with him in 2008. So we talked about sort of the circuits here in the brain for attention, for working memory, for regulating stress, for making good decisions, and that science has better instruments now, that we've had a lot of progress since 2008, and the industry has grown a whole bunch. Alvaro has been putting out an industry report every other year, and back in 2005, it was a $200 million industry, and in 2012, they measured that it was a $1 billion industry worldwide revenues. And there's companies like Lumos Labs and Newer Science and Emotive and so forth. There's hardware, software, and a bunch of other things making their way into the marketplace. But that wasn't kind of enough. So they published a book recently so that people trying to figure out what on earth this is and how to do it can do something about that and kind of get educated. And a big theme through the call was Alvaro saying, look, we don't really fully understand enough about how all these mechanisms work, and there's a lot of misconceptions about it. So the education has to proceed or go with any kind of reviews or product. That just saying this is good, this is bad, is kind of not good enough in different ways, and that the media is doing a very poor job of explaining this. So he then talked about how pattern recognition usually gets better with age, except that if your environment is changing very quickly, pattern recognition can work against you because you start using 10-year-old patterns in the current moment and they're out of date. And then there's a lot of functions that decline after our 20s and 30s. So if in the old days, if we had a life expectancy of 50 years, that's okay, so fine. But now we're living 25 years longer. So think of brain fitness as something you would invest in, just like your financial portfolio. And he had a very nice chart, which basically showed the decline of brain function over time. And then another arc above and to the right of it, saying, you know, in the one sense, you can improve performance, you can increase your performance or raise the curve, and you can delay disease or delay the onset of that decline, so move the curve to the right. That being sort of conceptually what we're thinking about doing, and now there's lots of non-invasive ways of doing that. You can change your lifestyle, you can use technology as well, you can really, there's a lot of ways in which we can intervene in ways that free us from the notion that this might just be genetic, in which we are fated from birth in the genes we have, to rather an epigenetic view, which is how our genes are expressed in our lives through our context really matters. So then we talked about three different sort of major branches here. One is this notion of lifelong neurogenesis and neuroplasticity. Every morning you can probably welcome 2,000 to 4,000 new neurons in your brain. And if you were to watch TV for 6 hours a day for 6 months, you would rewire your brain probably in a very negative fashion. Versus going and starting a startup someplace or doing something really challenging and stimulating and relevant in managing the stress of doing that. So then the second major area was cognitive reserve, this whole notion that as we create more neurons and connect them better, we can actually remember more things. And the third area was this notion of digital innovation, where there's really new mindsets and new toolkits available, and that so we're starting to understand how to develop critical brain functions better. Then there's, you know, leadership is not just sort of this label that you apply to people, but in health, we're starting to understand real health, which is a function of emotional well-being, physical well-being, social well-being, and learning how we develop. Healthcare systems haven't really been a very good ally in developing brain fitness, with a couple exceptions, which we talked about in the Q&A. So then Alvaro proposed a 12-year-old boy named Juan, so we could think about his working memory, and he gave us the quiz, and fortunately he didn't come back at the end of the call and ask us to recite the number backwards, but he said, can you remember this phone number backwards, which was in fact really hard to do. You had to very much focus. We're so organized on seeing a number going forward. But it turns out that working memory is not only essential, but developable. And in conditions like ADHD, lots of organizations are beginning to figure out how to do this. So computers and things can be helpful. 3 years ago, Pearson, the education company, bought Cognet so that they could bring this kinds of technology into the classroom. Then a separate case, we talked about stress. And Alvaro talked about building emotional resilience and self-awareness. And one of the practices that seems to be very popular for stress management is mindfulness meditation, which I'm a big fan of. But also, people are starting to look at video games and different sorts of heart rate variation, biofeedback, and other things that are really interesting here. So we're seeing athletes and traders and others getting connected up. And this was kind of a surprise to me from what you said, but there are some traders who apparently wire themselves up to some of this gear, and when they notice in the middle of their trading day that actually when they don't notice, because there's the system they're wired to will trigger an alarm that will tell them to take a break for a while because they're getting too emotionally involved, or some measure is out of range while they're trading. So Alvaro said we need new mindsets and toolkits for all this, that cognitive training can be a really great remedy. He talked about a study that was published in the Journal of the Canadian Medical Association that talked about all the different interventions that people do for cognitive capabilities, from nutrition to exercise to drugs, and the best of them was actual digital cognitive training, and this did not get a lot of media attention anyplace. So the last part of his presentation was a puzzle image. In which he said, look, we need to be aware of our biases, but we need to reinforce what we understand and what we believe and what we do, because we have all these biases. So he presents a puzzle so that we can walk through and understand which parts of this puzzle we're actually missing. Do we understand awareness, how this all works together? And so that we understand that we might be very, very good at one piece of the puzzle and be doing enough of it that the extra hour has no marginal benefit. But that if we then invested an hour in learning how to do mindfulness meditation, for example, it might have very, very high payoffs. And how to hit minimum thresholds for all these different areas instead of just focusing on one thing that we particularly like. And understanding what kinds of things work and what kinds of things don't work. So, how do you cross-train? There's a whole bunch of tools around meditation, reframing, biofeedback, cognitive training, etc., etc. And in the book, they offer 10 to 15 vignettes to try to demystify this area. And alongside the book, they've also got a conference that runs every year. So I asked then about the healthcare exceptions, and Alvaro pointed us toward Canada and the UK, which are very advanced. In Canada, Bakerston University has been developing this, because they've really been understanding that aging matters a lot. That it turns out the RAND Corporation did a study on the cost of healthcare for dementia, cancer, heart treatments, etc., etc. And it turned out that dementia was more expensive than pretty much every other thing. So people just losing brain capacity cost society an awful lot. He pointed to a Canadian company called Cognicity that has a really nice assessment of cognitive health. Then he turned to the UK in the National Health Service, which has been focusing on anxiety and depression. And when you show up and say you're feeling anxious or depressed, rather than feeding you pills right away, they send you to a program online called Beating the Blues. And that doesn't mean they won't prescribe, but it means that at least there's an intervention before you get there. In the US, there's a focus on driving fitness from a couple insurance companies, including Allstate, because cognitive training can actually help people be fitter drivers for longer. Also, Nationwide and UnitedHealth and a couple others are working on benefit plans where there's half-hour assessments of cognitive and emotional fitness. Cisco and a couple other companies include these in their healthcare plans. This info is never shared with the employer, but it's a really great benefit to help employees assess where they might be. I asked, well, with aging, isn't Japan interested here? And he said, Asia, Singapore, South Korea, and Japan are really taking the science seriously, and they're focusing really a lot on education. They're working with Duke University in Singapore. Singapore's working with Duke University to create some quantitative EEG information so that they can start understanding attention. A lot of this sort of got on the net, on the international radar when Nintendo created a game called Brain Age. And so there's a lot of attention coming at this from video games. I asked about measures, and Alvaro said, remember, I'm an economist, not a scientist, but science has been pretty myopic sometimes, and maybe they think that controversies lead to more research funding, but it's really important to figure out what we're measuring and what these outcomes are. And all too often, the measures are for doctors, not for the patients. But what's beginning to happen is that some of this information is coming toward patients. So there's an iPad app Alvaro mentioned called Brain Baseline that has 16 or 20 tests in it that are validated. The app is not beautiful. It's not a gorgeous Web 8.0 app, but it's really, really helpful. Then there's also, for emotional fitness, there's a website called My Brain Solutions that is pretty clinical but really good, that has a 30-minute assessment. And then this is where he mentioned about traders, wiring themselves up so that an alarm would go off. One of the devices they use is from a company called M-Wave, which had an original product in the $200-$250 range, now has a mobile product that is about $150 and has recently launched a sensor that goes into your iPhone jack for $80 or $90, which looks really interesting because this is I love the heart math and trainment and all that. I think that's important important research work. So then I asked, isn't mental fitness social just like physical fitness is in different ways? And he said, well, 5 years ago, most of the research was all individual, and now most have some social dimension, at least comparing your performance with your peers or maybe with your friends. And he pointed out that there's several chapters in their book. One is titled, Oh, the Places You Will Go, a play on the children's book, but then the next chapter is, Oh, the People You Will Meet. And then he agreed that not all interactions, social interactions, are in fact beneficial. You might be in sort of a really negative social circle, and your emotional health might decline considerably. So also, if you just hang out, there's no particular benefit. You need stimulation of different kinds. You need to be making something significant or developing empathy or whatever it might be. So this might be a way of architecting, and then we sort of zoomed the lens back a little bit and thought, well, a lot of these things we're talking about brain fitness and the consequences, can turn into advice about architecting your entire life experience in better ways. So that was a really good thought. So scientists he's run into sometimes say, think of life itself as the best gym for the brain, that reality is your great gym. Adam Emmerich jumped in and said, well, what about, just a simple question, what about awareness? Who knows about this? Is there a need for this? And Alvaro said, look, 10 years ago, there was pretty much zero awareness about this. Later, he said it was a lot like physical fitness, which at the beginning, there were some people in LA who maybe out of vanity or whatever started exercising and getting fit and doing bodybuilding. And the early medical establishment said, said pish-tosh to it. And then 40 years later, look at what we have as an industry around physical fitness. So then he pointed to Brain Age's success, mostly in Asia and Europe, but also a bit in the U.S., raising awareness. And a JAMA study, Journal of the American Medical Association study titled Active, where they trained 3,000 people over 55 years old in several different methods, and they tracked the impact over time. And the 5-year follow-up study, I guess published in 2005 or 6, showed very measurable baseline benefits from doing brain fitness sorts of things. Then he pointed also to an NPR series about brain fitness in the US that pointed to things like neuroplasticity, in particular parents of children with difficulties, whether it's ADHD or other sorts of things. Canadian schools are building in some of these sorts of things. And then there's some work on brain fitness in the leadership vein, but much of it is misguided. It's based on really old theories that have timed out. So Adam also said, well, sort of what's the path forward? And Alvaro sees a lot more interest in mindfulness in leadership circles in particular. And then, stay tuned. He's giving a keynote for the conference board in June, where he'll be talking about all of this in the context of human resources, the future HR is being involved with the brain. So I mentioned the book by Sharon Begley, co-authored with a neuroscientist about neuroplasticity and how shocking it was to me that so much capacity can come back after many kinds of stroke. And then Alvaro said, well, imagine that you went to the gym and only exercised your right bicep. We don't understand all the different parts of our brain, so we may in fact focus on one thing at the expense of other sorts of things and be pretty imbalanced. He pointed to a Soviet researcher after the World War II, Luria, Alexander Luria, who had in fact worked really hard to help soldiers overcome trauma, using this same sort of process I talked about for stroke recovery. So, but they needed to have serious impairments. And out of this came the fields of neuropsychology and cognitive and affective neuroscience. Then I playfully recommended that Alvaro start a Brainmodo site, riffing on Gizmodo, but for brain tools. And Alvaro really feels that just doing a review isn't enough, that we need the education behind it. So he feels that the book is really important at this point so that we understand how these things work and how they fit, rather than just go, oh, this looks cool, that looks cool. He said that, the neurons are the famous elements of the brain, but there's also glial cells. And this in response to my question about the three brains, some stuff I've been running across recently. Now, traditionally, the three brains, if you're talking about just straight neuroscience, mean the reptilian or limbic system, the mammalian brain, and the neocortex, which is sort of the modern brain up front. But I meant a different set of three brains, being the one in our heads, the one around our hearts, and the one around our digestive system, because each of these have very extensive neural networks. And so Alvaro said, yeah, that's interesting, but mostly probably at this point it's curiosity. The important stuff is happening very likely in the head, and in fact, as we talked a little bit later, in the neocortex. We talked a little bit about embodied cognition, that it's just not what's going on inside your skull that matters, but it's at this point sort of not as practical in different ways. We talked about gut instinct and the microbiome a bit, and this notion of crystallized pattern recognition. And again, that if your patterns have crystallized too much, you might in fact respond in a way that would have been appropriate a dozen years ago, but isn't now if the world is changing a lot. And he said, look, I was raised in Spain, and I realized that some patterns that worked in Spain don't work here, and vice versa. And he pointed us toward Danny Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, for more insights. Then I said, oh, so does neuroplasticity vary by the region of the brain? And he said, yes, that from our research perspective, it looks like the prefrontal cortex is the most flexible. It's also the one that develops the latest. Sometimes it develops sort of in our late 20s, really at full maturity of that area. It's also the first region to decline, and it responds a lot to experience. So partly that's probably what makes us the most adaptable species, this neocortex. So in the next years, he sees a physical fitness frontier, and as I said a moment ago, that remember what physical fitness looked like 40 years ago. So imagine brain fitness being at that early stage. And imagine that in a few years it might actually be everywhere, and we would have new job categories and new capabilities to do that. That brings us to the end of Change Your Brain Trajectory, the 388th Yitan Tech Community Call held on Monday, May 6th, 2013. Alvaro, thank you very, very much for your time, attention, your brain, and your patience with your cold. And thank you, everyone else, for joining us.
You're right. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you. Feel free to add comments and pages on yitan.com, and please tell your colleagues to join us again in 2 Mondays when we'll have another conversation about change. I'm Jerry Mikulski. Thank you again, and goodbye for now.
This podcast is published under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 license. It was edited and published by Sasha Mirkailo. Thanks again for listening.